Welcome to VBAC Bird Stories. Join us as we speak to Australian women about their journey towards a vaginal birth after cesarean.
In Australia, the cesarean rate has risen to 36%. That's one of the highest rates in the developed world. We hope that by sharing these stories, women and their care providers are able to gain insight into why these rates are on the increase. We also get to meet and understand the women behind these numbers.
We are your hosts, Mel and Steph, and we hope you enjoy Season 3 of VBAC Birth Stories. Hi everyone, it's Mel here. Hope you're all going well. Just wanted to start off by saying we're sorry it's taking a bit longer for us to release episodes lately. There's a lot happening in our personal lives with Steph at work, and in my case, my toddler is keeping me very busy during the day, and making time for editing is actually proving to be quite challenging lately for us both. But I'm so glad we're still able to get out episodes to you, albeit not as frequently as we would like, as we know how important the public sharing of VBAC birth stories are for not just for those who are pregnant listening in or planning. It's also really important for healthcare providers. Thank you to our patrons on Patreon for your support as always. If you would like to support the podcast, you can from $2 a month, or you can also just say thank you by making a one-off donation via Patreon. Your donations go towards the upkeeping costs of running the pod and are very much appreciated. Thank you so much to this week's guest, Tina, who has contacted us from Melbourne. She's a registered nurse and a mama of two. Tina shares her two very different birth and postpartum experiences with us. After Tina's son was born via an emergency cesarean, he experienced what is called TTN, transient tachypnea of the newborn. Babies with TTN have extra fluid in their lungs, or the fluid leaves a bit too slowly, and it is more likely to occur in C-section babies. She shares what it was like for her having a baby in special care and then the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit. And she also talks about postpartum. Having an unexpected surgical birth played a heavy role in her overall mental well-being in those early days. In her VBAC pregnancy, Tina opted to have a student midwife follow her on her journey, and we are very thankful that Tina invited her student midwife, Rebecca, to today's interview, so you will get to hear her perspective on VBAC and following women as a student midwife a little later on in the show. If you're new to the podcast, in the show notes, you will also find a list of affiliate brands that you are able to enjoy discounts with through a special code or link with us, so be sure to check them out after the show. For now, please enjoy this special episode of VBAC Bird Stories, and thank you again for your support. Okay, today we are with Tina, who is in Melbourne with her little baby, Livia, and we've also got Rebecca here, who is Tina's student midwife from her VBAC pregnancy. But we'll start by, Tina, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I'm Tina, a mother of a three-year-old and an almost 6 months old. Our family with my husband, we live in Melbourne. Both of us are registered nurses, and I do oncology or cancer nursing.
So I guess being registered nurses, what were your preconceived ideas about birth before falling pregnant the first time?
My preconceived notion would be it will hurt. And then part of which would be because my mom, I guess, is a tough one in terms of, you know, physicality. So I think by just staying physically active and fit, I will have a normal vaginal water birth delivery. That was what I wanted. And then in nursing school and in placements, you know, it is quite medicalized because the only privatized system that I somehow saw before I fell pregnant for the first time was my mom's in TV shows. My pregnancy was textbook normal. And we even joked about it at work because my work is just across where I'm going to give birth. You know, there was a joke like, look, you can work until you start laboring and then we'll just wheel you out. And I was like, okay. But So I was working full-time and up until 36 weeks.
Just before you go into sort of the end stages of your pregnancy, I'm curious, you mentioned your mom there, you know, her birth experience, I guess, was one of the things you drew on. Did she give birth here in Australia?
No. So she gave birth in the Philippines, but in a hospital. Yep. And she has like an OBGYN with her, you know, like, but she birthed normally. Part of what was going on through my mind is that cesarean section, it's not going to happen to me. My husband and I attended a birth education class run by the hospital. But looking back, I just took in what I wanted.
Actually, I'm curious because I wanted to ask you about that because I remember going to the same thing in my first pregnancy. Do you feel like they sort of skip over the cesarean part in that education class, or do you feel like it was discussed at all? Like if you do end up needing to have a cesarean, this is what will happen?
I remember it was discussed, but not like thoroughly. You know, look, it's a worst case scenario. And plus, I'm not listening to it because I'm just like, it's not going to happen to me.
And exactly.
I'm just so, and I was just so focused on like, I'm going to have water birth and these will be my types of pain management. I'm not going to go for morphine.
Tell us, did you go into spontaneous labor then, Tina?
I remember vividly. So at about 3:15 of that was a Saturday, the contractions woke me up. And I went to the loo and I started seeing there's more blood because 2 days prior to that, I've already had like a bloody show.
And how many weeks were you, sorry?
38 weeks plus two at that time. After that, you know, I was like, oh, I got to time this. Because, you know, that's how you do it. I told my husband, like, look, I'm having regular contraction. You got to get ready. And my husband at the time was also taking like a post-grad. Like his reflex was, I'm going to do my assessment soon. So he took out his laptop and tried to finish.
Isn't that funny? Some men do that. And it's almost like they have to have their own project, like their own baby that they're having, right? Like, I need to focus on this. And it's like, no, there's a baby coming.
So he did that. And, you know, I just let him be while I called basically the hospital, and then they told me like, okay, how is your contraction? Contractions are not established yet. And so after some time, I was like just timing it. Looking back, it's like menstrual cramps really. I spoke to the midwife and she just took my word for it, like, okay, your contraction is this. So it was about probably 6 a.m. They told me like, oh, there's still no room yet. You know, we were just waiting and waiting and waiting. And then, boom, there's a room, but it's not the birthing suite. It's just like another assessment room. I remember the room was brightly lit and it was annoying me. But being a newbie, I did not bother like closing it. Like I was just like leaning over those side tables. I don't want to sit down. I was just up. What I was doing through the contraction, you know, it's like I'm tensing rather than like vocalizing or moaning. I was just like, oh, no. Like, here's the contraction. Really. And then someone, a midwife, like the one that and asked me if she can do internal examination. So I said, yeah, sure. Like, do an internal examination. And, you know, she did not tell me like how dilated I am. She just went out again. She was telling us that she's busy. There was another lady in another room. I've given them my birth plan because, you know, just in case if they don't have a copy, I've tried to make it really condensed, like simplified so they can read it. Like, and so I told them that I wanted water birth. And then she came in again and then asked me like if she can do again another internal examination. And I was like, sure. After that, she just told me like, looks like the plan has changed. We were thinking of sending you home, but I've noticed like a meconium liqueur. Okay, I gotta stay, but I'm in so much pain now. Like I was like asking straight away, like, can you give me an epidural? And she was telling me, in this room we cannot give you an epidural. It's just what we can give you would be morphine, paracetamol. She even offered me that. And then I asked, what about a gas, like gas. Oh, sure, like, okay. But she offered again morphine. No, no, I don't want morphine. But then she also told me that I cannot do water birth anymore, you know, since I had meconium liquor. She has to strap me in and monitor. So, you know, like, okay, right, okay, fine, just do whatever you want. And then she explained to me that the gas won't really take the pain away, but it will just take the edges off. And it helped me go through the contraction. But also I started now looking at the monitor, and every time I see the numbers go up, I was like, oh no. And so I thought that was the pinnacle of pain. But it was about after lunch that we finally got a room in a birthing suite. So there's a different midwife now. Inside the birthing suite, she asked me if she can do an internal examination. And I said, sure. She showed me an amnio hook. Right after she put in that hook, water gushed out. That's when I started, like, it's like I can hear, like, the drums, like, boom, 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 boom. Pain, boom, 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 pain. Oh my goodness. And that's where I was just like, that's the time that I started, like, where's the epidural? I want the epidural. And I was just boring my nails on my hubby's hands, and they placed in a cannula. So the nest came in, and they wanted to, you know, like, they have to reposition me, basically be, you know, propped up, and they have to look at my back. It was hard, you know, like, with the wave of contraction that I'm experiencing, because I was already trying to be patient. Like, the goody-goody Tina went off of the window.
I love that the goody-goody Tina went out the window at that point.
My headspace at that time, I've given you time to explain the pros and cons. That was enough of a time. Now, this is not the time to repeat ourselves again and again.
Yeah. So did the epidural go in successfully after that?
Yes, yeah. It did. Good thing. And she visited me after that and, like, oh, and I said, hi, oh, this is better. That gave us respite. And up until a point, there was a med call, first med call. They all came rushing in. Bob is decelerating, you know, like a non-reassuring CTG. The midwife asked me, they have to put an internal CTG at that stage. They did that. And then she just asked me to change position. And after that, she did another internal examination. And afterwards, again, another med call happened. But this time, there was something different. After they've all rushed in, they've all gone out. Like, no one was left in the room. And I was like, something's up. A doctor came in and started telling me, like, look, Bob had meconium liquor. You know, it's taking longer than what we wanted to. Bob is showing some sign of distress, like heart's decelerating. Got to think of having a cesarean section. And when she mentioned it, I was already holding my tears. Do you want me, do I have to decide, like, straight away? For how long are you giving me the time to, you know, decide on this one? Like, we'll give you about an hour. Once she was out of the room, that's where I started, like, the dam just flowed. And what I was feeling at that time is that I, my husband, the student midwife, and the midwife, we were like, we're a team, and we're fighting hard to make this happen. And then after all that effort, it's ending to a C-section. But because I was also thinking, like, I have to think and decide, and this is for my baby, and so, okay, I'll do it. And they came in, you know, started telling me the complications, what will happen first, and then the complications. And I remember, like, what part of it is, you know, because part of it is the possibility that I might not pregnant again if I bleed, or if I, you know, they said, like, that's why we're gonna do the best that we can. And I was, like, signing the consent form, and I can barely, like, feel my hand. Like, I was so frustrated at that time, because it's like my hand is even numb. I cannot even, like, sign well. That was it. After that, it was so quick. I was also at the same time thinking, like, oh, this is how those people having surgeries feel like, because I haven't had any major surgery in my entire life. That was the first one. Yeah, it was quick. The moment that baby was out, I heard that cry. And I was like, what's that cry? It was quite weak, the cry. But they said that he was okay. So we had a photo. Like, I was just happy that he's fine. We were trying to breastfeed in transit. He was moving a little bit. When we arrived at the ward in my room, he stopped moving.
So when your son was born, then how was his heart rate then? Was there any checks on him as soon as he came out?
Yeah, so they did like the abdominal score, and he was actually fine. Like when he came out, we've had skin to skin. We've even had like the photo. Everyone was happy. But what I've actually noticed was just a cry, but they said like it was okay, because I was expecting like something louder.
Yeah,
it was like weak and wet. He was wiggling a bit in transit. And then when we arrived at the ward in my room, he stopped. And the moment that he stopped, the midwife looked at him and they started just rushing him out. He turned blue and stopped breathing. So I was left there like, okay, I cannot even move. And I'm just like, surely there will be someone who will explain this. So after a few minutes, a doctor came in and explained like, look, this normally happens, but he just spontaneously breathed again and he's fine. Like they did not even have to do intervention. Like once he was in there, he started like breathing again. After that, my husband came in with my son, and then we started discussing about like the right way to swaddle. And at this point, the midwife came in and was about to tell us like, look, this is how I do it. But then the moment that she said that, my son started getting blue again and stopped breathing again. And so we rushed out to the special care nursery, and that time they told me that he has to stay. So I was thinking, okay, like, look, I think it's better for him to be there rather than with us, because I'm really feeling tired. My husband, being a nurse, was just helping me express, and I was like surprised, like, oh, there's really something coming out. Like he was helping me out, because I find it like quite hard at first to express. We were just sending it every 3 hours. We're sending it to the special care nurseries. And then Dawn, he came in, my husband, from the special care nursery, and told me the news that they've transferred my son to the NICU. It's because he is desaturating, or, you know, like the oxygen saturations are going down, you know, seizures, and then this, what is happening? When I woke up that morning, I've just forced myself to sit up and, you know, just try to sit first and then transfer myself to like from bed to a chair. And I saw the midwife, and I told the midwife, I wanted to wash myself. And she said, sure, you can. And I think how she understood it is that she will be there. Like she will just get stuff, you know, like towels and all. But she was surprised when she was back, like I was already washed up. And I was like, oh, I'm done. It's like, oh, you're done. And I told her like, and I also plan to visit my son. She asked me like, oh, okay, but how are you going there? I'm gonna walk. And she's like, no, you're not walking, because it's like it's less than 24 hours and it's post-surgery. Here's the wheelchair. And then my husband came in. So we went to NICU. When we went to NICU, I saw him and I just like, oh, I wanted to hold him. And good thing it was a time for, you know, that I can do that. We can cuddle at that stage. But what broke me at that time is like, it's like he wanted to feed. He cannot feed because it's not allowed. Like he has high flow oxygen and he also has like a tube for feeding. And he's not allowed to feed at that stage. And that was just like, oh, I cannot even give what he wanted, and that broke me. I was just like crying and but, you know, but also at the same time thankful that I can hold him at least. And so after that, So back to the room, there was a moment in the room, I was just like staring at the window and I was like trying to reflect and having that moment, like, what happened? I was like cut open. And is this motherhood? Like, I'm not feeling anything. You know, like, if I'm just going to be honest, I'm not actually really feeling anything. Because I guess I have that expectation that it would be like, oh, it would be full of, you know, joy and celebration. But I'm not feeling that. But, you know, I'm just quite scared at that stage to say it out loud. But that was, I was just not feeling it. I was like, you know, with breastfeeding and breast milk coming out, I thought I'm not having enough. Like, I thought I was under, I was starting to discuss with my husband, I'm going to probably have to take Motilium because it's like, it's not coming out. But then it was day two postpartum that it, you know, it came out. So breastfeeding per se wasn't so much of an issue. Like, I've had like even oversupply eventually, like from thinking that I was under supply, I'd had oversupply. That was with my firstborn. I feel like even mentally, it was, it's so different. It's so different from, I was crying at home. Like, I felt like I did not know really what to do. When I reached home, it's like, at least, you know, my husband was there taking over. I'm trying to, it's as if I can speed up recovery. Like, it was just about a week. And, you know, like, there is a midwife visit postpartum, and she told me, like, look, it's been only a week, you know, pace yourself. It's like, because I already like, no, why am I not, you know, why am I not back to my normal self? Why can I, you know, do what I wanted, you know, the things that I wanted? It's just so sad, I'd say, like, because it's not what I expected it to be.
What did they say in the end about your son? What was the diagnosis? Was there one?
They said that it's common with child through cesarean birth, the TTN, the transient tachypnea of the newborn. So basically, he didn't have that squeeze from the pelvis that can squeeze out like the extra fluid from the lungs. So that's why he developed that. They've given him antibiotic just to rule out infection, and I don't have any problems with that.
That last, like, do you know how many centimeters dilated you got to before your surgery?
Yeah.
Do you remember?
From the last internal examination, I was told that it's just 2.5.
Were you worried when you went home about the blue episodes? Like, were you worried about that, or did you feel pretty confident?
I'd say neither. I wasn't, yeah. Like, I felt like everything was just happening so fast. I think my husband was more concerned of that. He's like checking, like, is he breathing? But I wasn't like that at all. It's like, I'm not tuned in. I'm someplace else.
Yeah. Did you have support? Does your mom live in Australia?
Nah. So, you know, none of that family support, mainly like friends. I've started reaching out with a friend of mine who just gave birth, you know, who's also similar, you know, like basically migrants. And she was just telling me, you know, like, it's hard, but it's comforting to know that she was also like crying almost every day. And I was like, okay. There was a question in the questionnaire. This is like postpartum now. I think the question was, do you feel, I guess it was happy. I cannot remember exactly the question, but do you feel like happy in the things that you, yeah. And the things that you love doing? And I was like, I was just, again, if I'd be honest with myself at that time, I was not. But because I was thinking like, no, I'm not, no, like I have to be okay. I have to, you know, I have to hold things together because I have basically a baby. I just have to be strong and take care of this baby. I'd say I've normalized what shouldn't be normalized.
So Tina, well, looking back now, if you had to summarize your first postpartum experience, how would you summarize that time for you after your first birth?
It was difficult. It was hard. I don't just say that. Even my husband shares that, you know, it was really hard.
And how much of that would you attribute to the birth?
Even if my family is not around, you know, we got friends, and there were also people in the church that sort of helped us, you know, at least visited us to have that sense that we are here for you, you know, and we appreciate them for that. You know, they've even supported us, especially during the difficult time, like, you know, with my son being in NICU and all. But I think it has something to do with that feeling was more of the surgery, the surgical intervention, and that, I guess, that space that we should have been together. I guess we should have bonded immediately. Plus, because it was surgery, the hormones weren't there. Wasn't there because I haven't gone through the process. Plus, the TTM was also associated with the Caesars. They've done what they can, the best that they think they know how. And I don't want to blame them for that. But, you know, if you're going to ask me, it's mainly because of the surgery.
And after you got home, how did your bond with your son change and grow over time? I mean, over that first 6 to 12 months, how did breastfeeding go and other aspects of postpartum?
So lockdown, I'd say, has been my friend because that's where I had more time. I had more time to really, like, focus on him, care for him, know him. I started becoming more confident. So more confident in, and now he's more into mommy, mommy, mommy now.
Would you say he was more attached to dad at the beginning? Or
they have a bond, and it's like my husband picked up his cues better at an early stage, but not now. Now it's so hard for him. he always needs my help.
Sounds like COVID was a good thing. I guess this is, we're talking 2020 here, that first lockdown period in Victoria, and that did some wonders for your relationship with your son. Did you ever think about VBAC? Was that discussed prior to your discharge? And did you think, you know, about another birth and what you might like for that birth?
When it comes to the discussion of VBAC, I don't have any memory at all that it was discussed. And it's not even in my notes.
So when you did fall pregnant with Livia, what was your headspace like? Had you done any reflecting on your birth and what you might like to do, and how are you feeling, I guess?
With Livia, the reflecting part was I was already pregnant. That was the process when I was like trying to prepare for the VBAC. That's when the reflection came in. But I've thought about VBAC prior to getting pregnant because I've seen an influencer in her blog that she was actually thinking of doing VBAC. And I was like, oh, yeah, I can do that. That sounds, yeah, I can do that. You know, I even remember telling my husband for the first time, but I guess I made a mistake of telling him about the risk straight away of having VBAC because I told him, like, you know, part of the risk is the common one is the uterine rupture. And he was like, no, you're not. You have to think about a baby. But then I have to stop myself. Okay, this is not how I should be telling him about VBAC. I'd say I've done a lot of things quite differently the second time around. So I've decided to have the continuing nursing program, which I did not regret. I was so glad I did that. Because, yeah, so Rebecca was a good resource person and even a support person. There are a lot of things that I realized that I don't know. Evidence-based birth also, I've checked that out. I've relied heavily on it. And although it's American setting, but a lot of it.
Yeah, it's a really great resource. Yeah.
So Rebecca sent me one of the Queensland guidelines, and then I just started checking the clinical guidelines of Queensland. So I was like looking at the diagram, like checking out my chances and how, you know, like in terms of system, how can I, you know, to make me understand this better, why are they doing the things that they do? Why, when do they decide to augment pregnancy and things like that? I thought the Royal Women's doesn't have it, but they also have clinical guidelines. You can also access that. So I purchased Birth Map, the Birth Map.
Yeah, the Birth Map by Catherine.
Oh, yeah,
by Catherine Bell.
Oh, well, look at that. She's great. Even showing it to us.
Yeah. I did the birth map, and I think it helped me a lot in terms of just preparing me for anything and everything.
Scenario.
That took us with my age, that's also a factor, to the months that we were trying to get pregnant. I was off of it, and I still wasn't getting pregnant, and we were already at that point of, I already have the referral for a fertility doctor. Fortunately, yay, at the 7th month of trying, lo and behold, I'm pregnant. So we did not.
Then when you fell pregnant a second time, how were you feeling physically?
First part, I felt like I was not as fit as I was, you know, because now I got a toddler, and then, you know, I barely had time to really focus on like exercising. But I have this, because I've had a physio consult, and she recommended about Core Floor Restore.
Oh, yes.
Core
Restore.
Bernadette.
You know, funny fact, so Bernadette actually went to school with Mel and I as well. But we didn't realize this. But yes, she has a great program for pelvic floor. And
because I'm having like issues in terms of getting that urgency, I have like urinary urgency. And so the physio just recommend, you know, like I can check it out. That's what she said. But what I did, I bought the program, like the pregnancy program, and it's good because there's like birth class that's included in that.
You found that helpful, obviously. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Very helpful. It has given me like, oh, of course, the VBAC birth stories. It's like my sort of virtual, you know, like my online community in a sense, because like, oh, this woman get me, like, you know, like, oh, their experience, like, they get me, like, even if I don't, like, really know them, you know, like, the people sharing the stories personally, but it's like, oh, this is sort of my community, if you know what I'm saying. And then the Naked Doula, that's where I found, like, the comb, you know, like, in terms of pain management, the comb helped me a lot in my VBAC, in terms of pain management.
I have a question. How did you get your husband on board?
Right. So I started switching my conversation to focusing more on like the benefits, including, you know, like recovery would be faster. And I think when I mentioned that to him, aside from the whole host of other things, that's where like, oh, and then like, you know, in terms of mentally, how, you know, how it would help me, because I think he saw how I was like just crying and very sad, and, you know, like how I was in the early stages postpartum with my first birth. Yeah, like, and then I started showing him these evidences and started like reading it to him, you know, like all the statistics and like, you know, where I kind of sit. There was a switch, and I was just like really grateful that, yes, finally you're on board. But I was thinking like, come on, if you're not going to be on board, I'm going to have Rebecca anyway. As part of my team.
I was also going to ask you, how were those appointments? Because obviously, were you seeing different midwives in the midwives clinic? And then, but Rebecca, because she was your student midwife, would meet you at every appointment? Is that how it worked?
So what happened is it's a mix of, this is COVID era now, so it's a mix of face-to-face and phone appointments. My appointments with the midwives mostly, which is just three, so two out of three appointments with a midwife was through the phone, and the rest were just doctors. In terms of them being supported, so it's like there's a spectrum, like some sit like very supportive, some like, oh, but we're going to induce you at this week. Some it's so like, it's on you, like, okay, it's on me. So it was a time like, you know, she was already saying the risk, rupture, blah, blah, blah.
And did that concern you at all personally?
For the most part, no. Up until I was 39 weeks plus one. Because I started feeling a niggle along my surgical scar. And then I was listening to one of the episodes, which was episode 41 of VBAC Bird Stories about uterine rupture. I'd say that it was fine. It's good that I've heard it so that I would also be prepared for, you know, what might actually happen. And if I am willing, I have to come to that place. Am I willing to take the risk? I remember I was writing because I have like affirmation cards. The affirmation cards is both like verses, biblical verses, but at the same time, it's like a note for Olivia. Like once she's out, if it's okay, I'll just read it quickly. I said, in writing this, I'm currently at 39 weeks plus one, Olivia. Anxiety about uterine rupture visited me last night. Anxiety about being overdue and how it will sit with your dad. Overdue like beyond 40 or hitting 41 and making that right call to wait or to get induced. I got by thinking that it can be just lightning crutch, you know, that I'm feeling. Also, because I've read this in some articles, some women really hit the 42 mark or beyond that, but I've written here, but this one is still hanging. Until reassuring words that was written in Isaiah gave me peace. Because the verse was, do not fear anything, for I am with you. Do not be afraid, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Be assured, I will help you. I will certainly take hold of you with my righteous right hand, a hand of justice, of power, of victory, and of salvation. I was like, okay. I can deal with this. I'll face this. Yeah. And
That's great. Yeah. So wow. It
was your faith giving you confidence at that time, like in sort of inner strength in a way, that was what you turned to that really helped you, which is, yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, but it was crucial that the reality that it might happen was there.
Yeah.
And it was also important that I also have to know and just not just dismiss, you know, like,
yeah, that's never going to happen to me. Uterine rupture is extremely rare, but it, you know, it can happen. And I think the thing about Zara's story, it's so hard to listen to, and it's a difficult one, but we felt that it was important for us to share it with the audience because it can be that possibility for that one in very rare occurrences that it does happen.
And it helped me. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. Yeah.
In a way, it was even like, in a way, it was even empowering in a sense, like, oh, okay, this is the risk. I think I've had a conversation with Rebecca, like, either way, there's risk anyway. Like, even if I give birth vaginally without the history of a Caesar's, you know, some people die, like, you know, when they're giving birth. So,
yeah. So, Rebecca, I wanted to ask you, so how did you two come to meet in Tina's second pregnancy? And how are you feeling about the prospect of her having a VBAC and the risks associated with that from your perspective as a student midwife?
Yeah, sure. So I got lucky with meeting Tina. I had been on placement at the hospital where she was having her appointments initially. And one of the midwives there, I think, I don't know whether Tina asked about having a student midwife or whether the midwife brought it up with her, but said, you know, this is an option available to women. You can have a student follow you and support you. And then at a later date, the midwife came to me and said, I've got this number of this lady. She's interested. Reach out to her. Good luck. See you later. And so at the time, I was in my first year. I'm second year now. So, and Tina was actually the first woman that I reached out to. And so I was very excited, a bit shy. I sent her a message just saying, hello, I'm student midwife. Are you interested? And very, very fortunately, she said yes, like, let's. And it was really hard because it was COVID times.
Yeah.
And so I think
this was all sort of over the phone and
initially.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And we did manage to sort of, in between lockdowns and stuff, I managed to kind of get to a few of her appointments. Otherwise, I'd join on the phone. And I didn't know what was going on at that point. I was still so new to everything that, like, I just sort of, VBAC was a new concept to me as well. Like, it was all brand new, just being alongside a woman for her pregnancy was all new. But I actually think it was quite helpful because I feel like Tina and I were really learning together. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. The more I learned personally and the more time I spent with Tina and learned her story, the more excited I got for her. And the more I got to know her, the more I just utterly believed in her ability to do this. And I think I sort of joined her halfway through her pregnancy. And with each week that we caught up, there was just so much growth in her strength and her belief in herself. And it was just absolutely amazing, amazing to watch. So by the time it came around, I just wholeheartedly believed that she was going to do this.
Amazing.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Do you feel like from your perspective, I know this is all brand new to you, did you have any ideas about some of the challenges that VBAC women face in the system when wanting to pursue one? Did you have an idea like prior to this, or was it sort of, yeah?
No. So obviously part of like the beginning of our education is the concept of being with women. I think it's just midwives, just from day one, this idea of being alongside a woman and walking with her and being with her and respecting her is drilled in no matter what the case, whether it's C-section, first time, sixth time, VBAC, just meeting every woman where she is at. And we do get a bit of an insight into the ways that the system has failed women on the whole, and the way that the system has failed women in their health across the board. You know, so many of us come to this career because in some way we have been failed by the healthcare system or know someone that has been, whether it's pregnancy or not. So I definitely was very passionate already about just women being able to have the experiences that they want. But I definitely did not know the kind of fight that was involved with a VBAC. And once I sort of, Tina agreed to have me alongside her, I started doing my own research. And that was when I came across you guys. And I just binged like 15 of your episodes over a weekend. And just really, it just shaped my viewpoint of how strong women have to be and the challenges that they're facing head on. And I just really never want to be one of those midwives that a woman comes on your podcast and talks about her not believing and not supporting. And it just really, you guys have had an influence on the way that I want to practice once I graduate, because I do believe in women and I want that to come across in my practice. So yeah,
that's really wonderful. I wanted to ask you, how much did Tina tell you about her first birth, and what did you think about that? I mean, when she first told you what had happened in that, unfolded in that first birth?
Yeah, sure. I think it sort of, I would get a little bit more of the story each time, you know, and as Tina sort of, her trust in me grew, we should open up a little bit more. And I just remember sort of sitting there, we were in a waiting room one day, and I remember her sharing a little bit about, you know, the whole experience. I just kind of looked at her and I said, that just sounds really traumatic. And Tina sort of looked at me and said, yeah, I think it was really traumatic. And I just, it just really sort of re-emphasized her strength, because I think it can be really hard to take a trauma and shape something new and empowering out of that. That takes a whole lot of strength. And the fact that she was sitting there willing to fight for her VBAC, willing to fight for a different experience this time around, despite this trauma that her whole family had experienced, I just was amazed by the strength that that takes.
And for you, I guess, sorry, my son's in the background. I guess for you also being a student midwife, how much like are you able to bring to those prenatal appointments? I guess for women out there who may not know how that works.
Yeah, for sure. So basically across my degree, a requirement to graduate is that I have followed 10 women through their pregnancies. So that involves a minimum of attending 4 antenatal appointments, the birth, if the woman is comfortable, that's not compulsory, and then 2 postnatal appointments. But that's a minimum. I can sort of come to as many as she'll have me at, basically. I love it. It's my favorite part of the degree. So I can't provide any medical advice. I'm not qualified to give any medical advice, but what I can do is I can provide resources, you know, things like this podcast. I link it to all my women, and just sort of things that I'm studying that I might know a little bit more about, I can, yeah, just give access to the resources that I have. But also, like, I'm there for support, as an extra support person. I kind of, in my mind, I'm kind of like a free doula. Like, I'm not quite as qualified. Like, you're not paying for it, so you're not getting
prime advantage, but it's, I'm somewhere like
it's a it's obviously like a mutually kind of beneficial relationship, I
100%.
Guess.
It definitely.
And Tina, how did you feel having Rebecca there with you on this feedback journey?
There's no other way, you know, but to give them a chance and then trust them. That's how we all learn, right? Like we all are students at one point in our life. Look, I am just so thankful because she's, as I've said, she's a good resource person, a support person. Like, you know, I can talk to her like in a women birthing kind of way. And even the way that I viewed midwifery has changed. I remember before I was like, questioning why is it just midwives? Why are there no doctors? Like, you know, in terms of giving birth. But that has changed a whole lot. Yeah, and then when Rebecca mentioned about being like a free doula, because she was there like in the early parts of the morning when I was giving birth, because Nimrod rung her basically. And, you know, like she was just there like, okay, I'm here. I don't know if you've even had coffee or you're caffeine free when you
I zoomed down there. I got the phone call from Nimrod. It was, I don't know, it was like 5 a.m. Got straight in the car. I was there. No coffee yet. I was just hyped up on the adrenaline. Tina was the first birth that I witnessed. Yes, I wasn't missing it.
Take us to your birth story.
Yeah, I was just wondering, should we get Tina to the part, to the end of your second pregnancy there? And did you want to take us to what unfolded towards the end?
Oh, so I looked at the clock. It was 12:33. But backtrack a bit. My son at that stage, just, I really wanted like, when will I give birth? Because this is like, I thought the second time would be earlier than, you know, would be earlier than my first. I felt heavier. I felt like I'm more ready now. Like, and I'm already like 39 weeks. And I've also visited the chiro for the first time at 39 weeks. Because I was like, I think that would probably give me that, you know, enough of like, if I'm realigned, that might do it. But then I remembered Sunday night, my son was just so lovey-dovey, was so sweet with me. And he was just like so sweet. And I was like, oh, you're so sweet. And at 12:33, I started feeling like, oh, I'm having contractions. This is quite regular, but I'm just going to take time now. Like, look, I'm going to go to the loo. And then, so I went to the loo like several times. I drank my milk, you know, I'm going to try to get more sleep. Then I cannot sleep. I've even emailed Rebecca at 12:52 a.m. of like my last, it's like, this is my last hurrah. Like, before a big exam, it's just like that. This is like my last hurrah. I've sent her like my mental notes and then other relevant clinical guidelines that might help during the day. And I've also messaged her like, you know, I'm having regular contractions now. And then at about 2:20, like 2:30, right about that time, I told my husband, hey, get ready. I already told him, like, get ready. So, why? Like, I'm getting, like, I'm getting tense now. Like, just get ready. Just, you know, like, let's be calm. And he was like, okay, you know, like, he has to get ready. He has to ring work, has to ring our neighbor who's going to be caring for my son. Good thing that neighbor of ours is awake because he hasn't slept yet. So he was awake, and I've rung the hospital for the first time because it's like, it's really like, we've tried before I rung, we've tried different positions, you know, the modified rebozo. My husband was also doing like those pelvic squeezes, and it was still helping, you know, at that stage. And then the midwife that answered me like, oh, let me look at your file. And then she said, look, we gotta time it well. And when she said that, you know, we gotta time it well because you're for VBAC, I all of a sudden I felt like, oh, I like this lady. It's like, she is for me. She's not gonna ask me to like, okay, come on here. And then she said, look, ring me when your contractions is about, like, it's not even like the in-between, but the duration of the contraction. If it's like for 90 seconds and your bloody show, there might be some bloody show, but that's good. That's what we wanted. Okay. Just ring me when that happens. So I was like, okay, okay. And then you can also go to the showers. And it's like, oh yes, yes. Good thing that, you know, like she's like giving me like hints and then I started remembering like, you know, the things that I needed to do. And so up until a point that, you know, the positioning and the rebozo isn't working anymore. The pelvic squeeze is like, I don't want it anymore. Like, I'm going to go to the showers. And then, oh, it felt really good, like being under the hot, like hot showers. It's running on your back. Like, oh, this is good. I can stay here. Like, I can stay here forever. But at the time, I was already holding the comb. Every contraction, I'm squeezing the comb. So I was also, I'm vocalizing. And that's the difference, the big difference. I was like vocalizing and I wasn't tensing up. I was like, okay, all right. I'm just squeezing and squeezing the comb. And then all of a sudden, bloody show. There was like really a lot. But, you know, my husband was there just timing it. It's still the duration isn't even 90 seconds yet. And then I was like, oh, I was already like on my all fours now under the showers. And I was just like continuously like vocalizing. And the thing that's playing in my mind is that, oh my gosh, how am I going to get out of like of the showers? Like, can they just teleport me with the shower? And, you know, I don't want to sit in the car and drive to the hospital. Not at this. So it's the balancing act of like the contraction is not, you know, strong enough to hinder me from, you know, like being in the car and all. But at the same time, it's also, you know, like I don't want it to be too soon because I, you know, I don't want a whole like shebang of medical intervention just because I was there like early. It came to a point that it was like, the duration was 90 seconds and I was really like vocalizing like, and the pain is really, you know, it's at a point, it's not even menstrual cramps at all. I told my husband, like, look, ring her again. And she was actually expecting, like, she was expecting like at about 5 and we rung at about 4:30. And so she said, oh, I can hear her. That's what we like. And she said, okay, like, come to the hospital. And I was like vocalizing. I was, you know, my son woke up like, oh, what's happening to mommy, to mom? You know, like my husband just has to explain it to him. And then on the lift, I was like moaning in the parking lot of the hospital. I was like stopping on my tracks, like, and once I hit like the emergency or ED, these geared ladies, because it's COVID time, like they're all geared up and like, oh, you're doing really well. Like, but I'm just so focused on, it's like, I'm just so focused on every contraction. I'm just focused on pressing my comb, moaning. And then they said, like, look, we're going to bring you to the birthing suite. Interestingly, when I arrived at the birthing suite, there's a big difference. The light is dim. And there's aromatherapy. And I was like, I actually commented, like, smells good in here. This is different. And then I've asked for water, like cold water. And my phone at that time, it was playing because I've subscribed to this Christian hypnobirthing app. So it was playing, but it was interrupted by an alarm turning off. And I was like, frantically, like, where is it? Where is my phone? It's sort of like my security, but yeah. Where is my phone? Look, I wasn't even following, you know, whatever the lady was saying. It's just like, I just have to have a listen to that. So when I found my phone, I tried listening to like it came up, like my playlist. It's not like I switched back to, because it's not working, I switched back to the Christian hypnobirth. Like, I'm going to listen to that. You know, like, I'm just, it's a good background noise for me. And they wanted to cannulate. So, you know, like an IV cannula, you know, I have to like think back and forth about this one, but I've agreed not. I did not decide that at that stage. I've already decided about that, like, previously.
Yeah, you were happy to accept that. What about continuous fetal monitoring? Because that's normally as well a recommendation, a protocol for VBAC. What were your thoughts on that?
I was okay with it. But what I don't want is just to see, you know, like the numbers nor the alarm. And I've actually seen the monitor on the side, but I would, you know, I just try to ignore it. But the IV cannula, she failed, like the midwife failed. So a doctor will come in. But, you know, I'm quite forgiving on that aspect. I understand. And then, so the doctor came in and then put in the cannula. There came a point that the doctor wanted to do an internal examination, like to go to bed. For me, she was asking me if I can go on a bed and do an internal examination. And I was like, no way. Like, it's hard. Like, in my head, it's just impossible at that stage. I cannot really do it. I cannot. So I've refused that. And I've learned from my husband that she found a way anyway to just to check, but did not really do an IE, but just to check how dilated I am, like, you know, with the mirrors. And because I was on all fours. I was on the edge of the bed. Sorry, not all fours. I was on the edge of the bed, leaning with my legs apart so they can check from there. So the midwives, like, you know, they have mirrors to check how I was going. And I think my husband also, like, tried to approach me. And I was just like, my instinct was just like telling me, like, okay, just stay put, like, just be there. And that's already fine with me. Like, I'm really, you know, my instinct was just like, don't touch me. Just, it's fine. Just be there. Just stay there where you are. My husband has to go. He already told me, like, look, I need to go because friend of ours, you know, like, in terms of the things that I have to bring to the hospital, I actually forgot some of the things that I have to bring to the hospital, and he was downstairs. And so I said, okay, yes. And then, but at that point, I was already like, I'm feeling quite tired because I was just focus on my birth. I think they might have told him, like, you know, don't go because she's near. I might have heard it, but I was not paying so much attention. And then there were several times I've asked him to, you know, like, pray for me, because the thing that's going on in my mind is it's like I wanted to give up. It's like I wanted to ask for an epidural at that stage. Again, I'm trying not to say it, because otherwise once I say it, you know, it's just gonna happen, like they'll give me epidural, and, you know, I don't want that. And I remember even Rebecca approached me, like, do you want me to pray with you? I said, no, it's fine. I just want them to silently pray so that I can have, like, this, you know, the strength to go through this. Prior to that, I've heard a pop. It's like a champagne pop, like a champagne bottle popping. It was like really loud, like, oh, the plug is out, like, oh, back again to, like, I felt like giving up. That was also the time that I finally, you know, my voice cracked and I said, like, okay, how dilated am I? And I just sensed there was a few seconds of pause, and then the midwife asked, like, do you really wanted to know? Oh, yes, I really wanted to know. And she said, like, you're 9.5 centimeters dilated. I was like, okay. You know, it took my mind, like, okay, let's do this. I'm gonna do this. I was so like, oh yes. I'm nearly there. But I'm also getting tired. And then the midwife mentioned that, look, Bob is also getting tired. We wanted you to be on the bed, you know, to help you out. And then when I was on bed, they've actually helped me, because I know that my push, because I'm trying to push, and I know that my push wasn't already strong enough, because I'm really getting tired at that stage as well. They said, like, if you feel the urge to push, just push. Nimrod is on one side and then Rebecca is on one side, you know, just to help me, like, my legs are spread. And then they asked me, do you want to feel your baby, the head of your baby? Oh, of course, yes, I wanted to feel the baby. In a moment, I thought, that's a weird feeling, but I know that it's not me, because, you know, how I'm expecting hair, but it's like moist and it's different.
Moist.
Yeah, I know that, but I know that this isn't me. You know,
so that's right.
Maybe, yeah, that gave me like, okay, I'm gonna push. I think this is more of what happened afterwards, because Rebecca and I were talking. She mentioned that the midwife was actually preparing for a warm compress, because I've requested for that, like a warm compress in my preemie. But the moment that she was just like preparing it, but the moment that I started, like they started seeing a tear, like I'm about to tear like a massive, like a third degree tear. And so they were like, they have to act quick. They told me like, look, we have to do an episiotomy, because otherwise, you know, you will tear. And they asked me to stop pushing. And I kid you not, I can't believe that I can actually do it, to stop pushing when there's an urge to push. Like looking back, oh, I can actually push and stop to push if I would want to. So I was on my back with my feet being held by Nimrod and Rebecca, you know, just to help me in terms of, I think every time I have the push, they sort of have to also push. I can also feel it like it's not as strong as I wanted it to be. They did an episiotomy. So I had second stage tear, but it was the episiotomy was done to prevent a third stage. And it was so quick, and the baby's out. And I was so happy. And I was just asking, I kept on asking Livia, like, how are you, Livia? Oh, how are you? It's as if she's gonna respond, I'm all right. Like, I've made it. And I basically don't care what's going on around me. Like, I was just so happy that, okay, finally she's out. And then they started telling me, like, you know, delivery of the placenta. I can't do a physiologic third stage because I was actually bleeding. I bled. It's about a liter of blood loss interpartum. And like, really? I'm bleeding. Like, I can't even feel it. Like, I am okay. Like, I feel okay. But yeah, do whatever. And I was just so, so happy. I can pick up like a little bit here and there that they were sort of like, they're busy. They're frantic because they're giving me this medication. They have to inject, you know, like for me to stop bleeding. I think they've given me tranexamic acid. They have to do like a derivative of a synthesin, you know, just to, and other medication to stop bleeding. And then after that, they told me that I have to go to the theater. What they'll do is that they'll inspect whether I need a repair and make sure that all the membranes are out. But turned out like everything was out. But there was a bit of hesitation on my end, because I was asking them, like, in case of emergency, would you be able to call, you know, like my husband to be there? But apparently they said they cannot, because if it's an emergency. But again, they've given me, that's just a worst case scenario. But I was willing to let that go, because I'm just like happy that Olivia is out. In transit, I was still holding the comb in transit to the theater. I was still holding the comb. And then there was one of the staff actually mentioned, like, oh, you got the comb. And, you know, I've also used that on the early stages of my labor. And I was telling her, you know what? I held on to it the entire time. There was a guy like, oh, I didn't know that the comb was a thing. Yeah. And it was general anesthesia. And then eventually I was up. I was glad that they've done that. That was the rest that I've had. And I was also happy to hear of the news that they did not even need to do like any opening. They just need to do a repair, because all the membranes were actually out. The amount of blood that I lost, because I also lost at about 400 liters. So it's 1.4 liters in total. But I am feeling great. I am feeling great. And even like I was in the ward, you know, like they were chatting with me, I was really feeling okay. And then in the afternoon, because I've delivered in the morning at about 8:55, and then in the afternoon I rung my dad, and he was just so shocked, like, who is there with you? Like, oh, you've given birth. Yes, I've given birth. And I remember I was also staring at the same sort of, because the wards are just on one side, because I gave birth in the same hospital. And I was looking at the window, and it was so different. Like, I don't have like that numbness and like, you know, questioning myself. I was just like, yes, it's so amazing. And my husband and I, we can't just stop talking about it. And he was also, sharing his experience on his end, like how things have unfolded. And yeah, it was just amazing, beyond amazing.
I was just going to ask you, Tina, you described your blood loss there. Was that considered a postpartum hemorrhage or?
So Rebecca, you do want to give the insight on that because you were also there about the bleeding.
Yeah. So, well, I can't comment on what happened in theatre, but just after you gave birth, yeah, there was quite a lot of blood. And you're right. It's so interesting. I was sort of moving in between like talking to Tina and meeting Livia, and I'd kind of move back down to the end of the bed to see what was going on. And it was seriously like two different worlds. From her waist up, there was just this bubble of euphoria and joy that like she'd had this beautiful baby and she'd achieved the VBAC that she'd worked so hard for. And then down the other end of the bed, there was a different energy with the midwives kind of being like, oh, this is quite a lot of blood.
Yeah.
So in the end, my understanding of what was kind of the main cause was that you had not actually emptied your bladder for quite a while. You had a very full bladder, and that can impede the uterus like shrinking down, and it creates like the blood loss. So they ended up inserting a catheter, and once you were able to empty your bladder, that helped to stop the bleeding quite well. So that's my understanding of what happened. Yeah.
How's your recovery been then, Tina? And how are you feeling today?
In terms of the short-term like recovery, I was just back on my feet. Like, it's just so different. When we reached home, because it's my son and my husband that was left at home. And I was like, this is how you leave boys, hey? Like, it's all messy. I have to like arrange stuff. But I was okay. I felt good both inside and out. You know, it's not just physically, but even my mental space. I felt like we can do this. I was just so into it. I'm doing the witching our breastfeeding and you know, like all of that. And I felt like I'm more in tune to Livia's needs postpartum. And then in terms of long term, we're still working on with the physio in terms of my pelvic floor. It's more of relaxing it. That's where my issue is mainly, because it's like it's just all tense and it's not contracting effectively if it's already like tense to begin with. I've actually pre-booked an appointment with a psychologist just so if in case I would go downhill, but I do not need it. Like, I have to ring them like, look, I do not need it.
Did you ever seek help from a psychologist in your first postpartum period?
I've thought about it, but I've never really done it. It was when I was already pregnant, that's where I really seriously considered it. That's why I pre-booked an appointment with a psychologist.
Well, it's really good that you had that foresight to, you know, acknowledge from what happened in your previous birth and postpartum and wanting to sort of make amends and make your postpartum a positive experience the next time around, you know, not knowing exactly how your birth would go and how you would be feeling. So that's good. It's really good that you didn't need it in the end.
If you had to give other women support who are in the position that you were in, what's something that you would say to them?
I think number one is to go for it. Go for it. Another would be, you know, like, it might sound a cliche, but, you know, expecting the best, preparing for the worst. And identifying your fears, you know, don't just dismiss them because they are likely to show up in the VBAC journey. Work through them. Perfect Love has a way of driving it out. If you got whether someone, a team or a community to lean onto, lean into them as long as they're supported. Identify what you want and why you want them, and are they attainable? And if they're not attainable, just ask that question. Is it really not attainable? You might be surprised of the answers.
Some good advice there. Rebecca, what do you feel you've taken away from meeting Tina and being involved in this process?
It's definitely sparked a passion and an interest for VBAC. I'm now in my second year, so I'm supporting a bunch of other ladies, and I have made a specific kind of effort to look for
VBAC mums. I'm supporting two more after Tina. It's just such a valuable experience. And I think I am definitely going to be bringing what I'm learning into my practice and just believing in women's abilities to do what they put their mind to, and believing the evidence. And also just the fact that, like, women are amazing. Women are magic. Like, Tina's birth was my first birth that I witnessed. She's my first woman that I followed. And it's just really emphasized the fact that women are incredible, and that women supporting other women is an amazing thing to behold.
That's really beautiful, and so nice to hear that. And thank you for listening as well to the podcast.
Seriously, you are an amazing resource. I send you even to my non-VBAC mums, because I think it's just such a worthwhile thing to sort of be aware of. And just, you know, it can be so hard to find your village, and hearing other women's stories, even if they're so different to yours, even if they're an entirely different experience, I think it can empower everyone to go for what they want. So yeah, you guys are just an incredible resource. So thank you for what you do.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot. It's nice to hear that feedback from a midwife, and particularly a student midwife. That's really wonderful. And thank you, Tina, so much for talking to us and for listening to the podcast yourself and sharing your inspiring story.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you for listening to this VBAC journey. If you like the show, please subscribe, leave us a review, or consider joining our Patreon. We thank you very much for your support.
VBAC Birth Stories is a podcast where we share women's lived experiences. Please be advised that it's not intended to replace medical advice. If you have any concerns at all during your pregnancy, please always speak to your healthcare provider.